You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Good evening. It is 5:04 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover news from the UBC campus, local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world.
All this plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now time for your local, provincial, and national headlines.
Tensions are high as the BC Teachers Assistant Union, CUP Local 2278, is seeking contract renegotiations with the university. On Wednesday evening, the union met in a closed meeting to discuss negotiations on a new collective bargaining agreement. In a recording the UBC obtained of the meeting, the union's chief negotiator, Roger Clark, stated that, quote, "We're pretty much in a position to wrap up all of the non-monetary stuff. There's a few loose ends. We've told them they're not important. What we care about right now is money," end quote. The union is looking for the same wage as the TAs at the University of Toronto, who earn $39.92 an hour, to the UBC's $28.42 per hour. According to Lucille McNeil, director of UBC Public Affairs, the wage proposals by the union would cost about $22.5 million, with a little less than $8.5 million going to tuition waivers for TAs. The union is now in a position to continue to escalate until they have something they can bring back to their members. No bargaining sessions are scheduled before February 29th.
A University of British Columbia study has found traces of the bacteria Listeria in ready-to-eat fish products sold in Metro Vancouver. UBC food microbiologist Kevin Allen tested a total of 40 ready-to-eat fish samples prior to their best before date. Purchased from several large chain stores and 10 small retailers in Metro Vancouver, these products included lox, smoked tuna, candied salmon, and fish jerky. The findings, published in the recent issue of the journal Food Microbiology, showed that Listeria was present in 20% of the ready-to-eat fish products. Listeria is a cause of the rare bacterial disease Listeriosis, a serious infection that affects primarily pregnant women, newborns, adults with weakened immune systems, and elderly. Author of the study, Kevin Allen, says that, quote, "Additional handling of ready-to-eat food in stores, such as slicing, weighing, and packaging, may increase the potential for cross-contamination. While Listeria bacteria can be killed by high heat, most people eat these fish products without further cooking. What this means for consumers is that pregnant women, the elderly, and anyone with a compromised immune system should be aware of the health risks," end quote.
The Canadian Institute for Health Research has announced a $2 million national study focused on how effective schools and community programs are in reducing homophobic bullying of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender youth will be taking place at UBC over the next 5 years. The study, headed by Prof. Elizabeth Sowick at UBC's School of Nursing, will document and assess the types of strategies that schools are using to foster connectedness, and reduce bullying, and track trends in health and safety among youth. The team will also study the experiences of heterosexual teens who are harassed because people assume they are gay. Says Sowick, quote, "Schools and communities are using a lot of different strategies to try to change this, but very, very few of these strategies have been evaluated to see not only if they work and how well they work, but why they work," end quote.
BC's 40,000 teachers held a day of action this Monday to consider the provincial government's plan to legislate an end to their contract negotiations. Before the Labor Relations Board hearing on Monday night, teachers have planned after-school rallies in Victoria in front of the legislature building and at a Surrey area. Susan Lambert, president of the BCTF, said that this would not affect classes as teachers will only be spending their lunch breaks discussing the issue. These negotiations have been ongoing since September. This day of action comes after Education Manager George Abbott announced last week that legislation would stop the job action, which has included teachers not completing report cards, would be discussed at the hearing. Abbott has said while teachers have a democratic right to escalate job action, it would only increase the harm to students and impact their parents. Teachers want a 50% wage hike during the government's net zero mandate for public sector employees. Abbott said, quote, "The union's demand, which would add $2 billion in cost to BC taxpayers, are not acceptable given the current financial reality," end quote.
Vancouver residents can expect a 2.5% property tax increase if council approves, in principle, its 2012 operating budget Tuesday. The increase includes a substantial jump for the Vancouver Police Department, including funds to hire 35 more officers and put in place recommendations from the Stanley Cup riot. But the $1.1 billion project also includes substantial fee increases for utility services and other programs to help close a $52 million gap staff identified in December between what the city needs and what it can actually afford. Those fee increases will cover about half the gap, with the tax increases raising another $15 million. The balance, which is about $10 million, will be covered through program efficiencies, according to a report to council. This year, the city also faces contract negotiations with five of its major unions, governing inside and outside workers, firefighters, electrical workers, and civic theaters. All of those contracts have expired. The Vancouver Public Library and the Vancouver Police Board are also in negotiations with their unionized staff.
The Canadian Avalanche Center has extended its special public avalanche warning to include mountain ranges in the northwest coast as the risk of slides increases. The warning was now includes the Cariboos, North and South Columbia's, Kootenai Boundary, the North and South Rockies, the Lizard Range, the Purcells, the South Coast Inland, Northwest Coastal and Northwest Inland regions. Anyone on the slopes is advised to stay clear of avalanche terrain this week as conditions are, quote, "very tricky to manage right now," end quote.
Those are your local and provincial headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break to bring you the finest in public service announcements. But stay tuned to CITR's News 101 for weather, which is going to be brought to you by the UBC Storm Club, and international news courtesy of our fine team here, and is, of course, FSRN.org.
Stanley G. Grizzle was born in 1918 in Toronto. As a leader in the Canadian Pacific Railroad Porters Union, Grizzle was instrumental in communicating information and advice from coast to coast. Grizzle and other porters on layover would contact local Black communities and help them to understand that their experiences were part of a broader pattern, and they would offer specific tactical suggestions for change. The Porters Union made alliances with other Canadian movements. Their ambition? To mobilize a concerted demand upon governments for legislative change.
This PSA was brought to you in support of Black History Month on CITR 101.9 FM.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Iqbal Ahmed.
And I'm Martin Lemlin. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, or online at citr.ca. Thank you very much for being with us. It's now time for the national news.
TransCanada Corp said it will spend $2.3 billion to immediately build the southern leg of its proposed Keystone XL pipeline, aimed to fill a shortage of crude supply to refineries while the company works to make the full Alberta to Texas line a reality. The move to build the southern leg will allow TransCanada to begin meeting refiners' demand for crude while starting a key piece of the full Keystone XL plan to link Alberta's oil sands to Texas refineries. The plan was halted late last year when the U.S. government ruled against the line's route through an environmentally sensitive area of Nebraska. TransCanada is working on a new route and said it intends to reapply for permission to build the entire controversial project within weeks. Supporters of the pipeline tout its impact on Canadian export development, job creation on both sides of the border, and increased North American oil security as major benefits of the project, while those opposed point to the environmental risks and the continual reliance on fossil fuels rather than new innovations and major reasons against the proposal.
The Conservative government backed legislation from the NDP today to improve education on reserves across the country. 4 years after a teen from Attawapiskatin, Ontario, began pushing for serious change. The legislation from the NDP seeks to equalize funding for on-reservation schools and put it on par with institutions funded through the provinces. For the past 16 years, annual education funding increases from the federal government to First Nations have been capped at 2%. Meanwhile, funding for provincial schools has increased by 6% each year. NDP MP Charlie Angus, who represents Attawapiskat in the region around Northern Ontario's James Bay, said he was, quote, shocked at the conditions when he first visited the remote area in 2004. School children on reserves get up to $3,000 less annually per person compared to their counterparts at provincially run schools. Meanwhile, the Assembly of First Nations believes that an additional $500 million each year is needed to bring reserve schools up to par. However, the motion passed in Parliament today isn't binding, raising concern that Ottawa may not act anytime soon.
It turns out that a Liberal staff member is behind the so-called WikiLeaks Twitter campaign, the House of Commons was told today. WikiLeaks took an aim at Public Safety Minister Vic Taves and was used to publish details regarding Taves' divorce. Interim Liberal leader Bob Rae spoke with the staff members responsible, Adam Carell, this morning. 2 weeks ago, the Twitter account was set up, followed by a string of posts that took jabs at the minister and his personal life, including quotes allegedly taken from affidavits from Taves' divorce. Adam Carell has worked in Parliament Hill for several years and offered his resignation this morning.
Those are your national headlines. We're not going to take a quick break. We're going to get right into the international news. Deadly unrest in Afghanistan has thrown a spotlight on the uneasy partnership between NATO and Afghan forces, exposing a potential Achilles heel for a war effort that depends on building trust with Kabul's soldiers and police. The White House and the Pentagon insisted today that attacks on U.S. troops, including the killing of two military advisors over the weekend, were isolated incidents and predicted turmoil over the burning of the Quran at an American base would soon blow over. But U.S. commanders are increasingly concerned about a rising trend of fratricide in the past 2 years, with Afghan troops turning their weapons on their American and NATO counterparts, often out of resentment and not due to an insurgent plot. The violence that has erupted over the past week after U.S. troops sent copies of the Quran to an incinerator at a Bagram air base seemed to underline a vast cultural gap between NATO troops and their purported Afghan allies. A recent report commissioned by the U.S. military found deep distrust and suspicion between Afghan and American troops, calling into question NATO's plan to build up the Kabul government's army and police to allow coalition forces to leave.
The German parliament approved a second 130 billion euro loan package for Greece on Monday after Chancellor Angela Merkel warned lawmakers that it would be irresponsible to abandon the country to bankruptcy. Although the motion was always expected to be easily approved, the final tally Monday was 496 votes to 90, with 5 absentees. The idea of bailing out Greece has remained very unpopular in Germany. The rescue package is Greece's second in less than 2 years. Greece has been surviving since May 2010 on an initial 110 billion euro or $148 billion package of rescue loans from other Eurozone countries and the International Monetary Fund. But more than 2 years of harsh austerity implemented to secure and rescue funds have left the economy in freefall, with businesses closing in the tens of thousands and unemployment at a record 21% in November. It isn't yet clear exactly what Germany's share of the new bailout will be, and the IMF's input this time has yet to be determined. But Merkel said, quote, "It is indispensable for the German government that the IMF continue to have a significant contribution and provide its experience and expertise," end quote.
A total of 231 nominees are up for the Nobel Peace Prize this year, the Nobel Institute said today. Gerd Lundstad, head of the Nobel Institute, said, quote, "As always, there are the usual nominees and some newcomers, some famous and some unknowns, hailing from the four corners of the world," end quote. With 188 individuals and 43 organizations, the number comes close to last year's record of 241. Among the people known to have been nominated this year are former United States President Bill Clinton, ex-German Chancellor Helmut Kohl, who led his country's reunification process, and Ukraine's ex-premier and now jailed opposition leader Yulia Tymoshenko. Also on the list is jailed American soldier Bradley Manning, charged with 22 counts for turning over a massive cache of classified U.S. documents to WikiLeaks. Despite its current crisis, the European Union is also among the candidates.
Those are international headlines. For more,
we are going to go to our political correspondent, me, for this week's look into American politics. Republican candidates have had it pretty easy for the past 3 weeks. There haven't been any primary elections, so it's been a time for them to take stock of their positions and adjust strategies. But we're ready to get knee-deep into the muck now. Both Arizona and Michigan will hold primary elections tomorrow, then Washington State on Saturday, and all this as a lead-up to the bombastic implications of Super Tuesday next week. These candidates are about to be put through the meat grinder. So let's take this opportunity to have one last look at the candidates as relatively bright-eyed, energetic, and idealistic candidates before the political gauntlet crushes them to a cynical, malleable hunks of jelly. The four left standing are...
Rick Santorum, the late contender, says it's a two-man duel now, and he'll be the one left standing.
I stand here to be the conservative alternative to Barack Obama.
Mitt Romney, the long-distance runner, says every rival that's threatened him has made him stronger.
My conservatism is to the core.
Newt Gingrich, the determined challenger, vowing to compete, win or lose, until the last votes are cast.
We intend to change Washington, not accommodate it.
Ron Paul, the delegate hunter, keeping his campaign going by picking and choosing his battles.
We have the message that America needs at this particular time.
The final four in Arizona, a state rich in presidential campaign history.
Hot damn! That was the epic introduction to last week's CNN debate in Arizona. Now, it could end up being the last debate that these candidates share with each other. It was also the first debate Rick Santorum faced as a supposed frontrunner in the top two, which means that the shit hammer would be swinging in his direction for a change. And oh, did the hammer swing fiercely indeed. Not only by fellow frontrunner Mitt Romney, but surprisingly enough, Ron Paul as well.
Congressman Paul, you've questioned the conservative, fiscal conservative credentials of all these gentlemen, but particularly this week, Senator Santorum. You have a new television ad that labels him a fake. Why?
Because he's a fake.
I'm real, man. I'm real.
Congratulations.
I'm real. Thank you.
Now, I find it really fascinating that when people are running for office, they're really fiscally conservative. When they're in office, they do something different. And then when they explain themselves, they say, oh, I want to repeal that.
In fact, it seemed at times like Paul was actually leading the charge against Santorum, making him look and probably feel like a withered old hack. And you know what? Ron Paul makes a pretty damn good argument.
It was the principal priority of President Bush to try to take on a failing education system and try to impose some sort of testing regime that would be able to quantify how well we're doing with respect to education. I have to admit, I voted for that. It was against the principles I believed in, but you know, when you're part of the team, sometimes you take one for the team, for the leader, and I made a mistake. You know, politics is a team sport, folks.
But once again, the senator's was for No Child Left Behind, but now he's running for president. Now he's running to repeal No Child Left Behind once again. But and he calls this a team sport. He has to go along to get along, and that's the way the team plays. But that's what the problem is with Washington. That's what's been going on for so long. So I don't accept that form of government. I understand it. That is the way it works. You were with the majority. You were the whip, and you organized and got these votes all passed. But I think the obligation of all of us should be the oath of office. We should take it. It shouldn't be the oath to the party. I'm sorry about that. But it isn't the oath to the party. It's the oath to our office to obey the law, and the law is the Constitution.
Ron Paul was at the top of his game in last week's debate. Despite the fact that he's the only candidate who hasn't actually won a primary state, and that he's still being cast aside as a hopeless loser, he absolutely commanded that debate. Now, it's nothing new that Paul was the only one laying down reasonable policies, but he was out for blood on Wednesday, and he continuously made Rick Santorum look like a brain-damaged amateur, be it on his stance on No Child Left Behind, his political record.
And they said that I was the most fiscally conservative senator in the Congress in the 12 years that I was there. My ratings with the National Taxpayers Union were A's or B's. They were very high from the Citizens Against Government Waste. I got a hero award. I was a leader, as you know, on taking on tough issues.
You know, that's always a cop-out when you compare yourself to the other members of Congress. The American people are sick and tired of the members of Congress. They get about 9% rating.
Or something called Title 10. A small part of a big bill that created federal funding for Planned Parenthood programs.
What I did, because Title 10 was always pushed through, I did something that no one else did. Congressman Paul did. I said, well, if you're going to have Title 10 funding, then we're going to create something called Title 20, which is going to provide funding for abstinence-based programs. So at least we'll have an opportunity to provide programs that actually work in keeping children from being sexually active instead of facilitating children from being sexually active, and I pushed Title 20 to accomplish that goal. So while yes, I admit I voted for large appropriation bills, and there were things in there I didn't like, things in there I did.
Good. John, this demonstrates the problem that I'm talking about. There's always an excuse to do this. Now, plan. Title 20, I don't know whether you inferred that I would support Title 20 for abstinence. No, it would cost money as a program. It's not a program of the federal government to get involved in our lives this way. If you want laws like that, maybe to say, but the federal government shouldn't even be spending money on abstinence. That's way too much more. I don't see that in the Constitution anyway.
Just a brief comment. Senator, I just saw a YouTube clip of you being interviewed where you said that you personally opposed contraceptives, but that you said that you voted for Title 10, but you used that as an argument saying this is something I did proactively. You didn't say this is something I was opposed to. It was something I wouldn't have done. You said this in a positive light. I voted for Title 10.
Now, Rick Santorum had his back to the ropes for a pretty good section of the debate last week, but he did manage to land some well-placed, albeit desperate, jabs in there, particularly with regards to bailouts, which could be a pretty important issue for voters in Michigan, because there's a massive population of blue-collar voters in the state who still have jobs simply because of the bailout of the auto industry.
He supported the folks on Wall Street and bailed out Wall Street, was all for it, and then when it came to the auto workers and the folks in Detroit, he said no. That, to me, is not a consistent principled position. I had one. I believe in markets, not just when they're convenient for me.
Nice try, but now let's look at the facts. All right, First of all, let's go back in the auto industry and go back to 2000, I think it was 2008. President Bush was still in office. And the three chief executive officers of the three major auto companies got in their private planes and flew to Washington and said, please write us a check. I think they wanted $50 billion. And I wrote an op-ed in the paper and I said, absolutely not. Don't write a check for $50 billion. These companies need to go through a managed bankruptcy, just like airlines have, just like other industries have. Like, I don't want to save any Wall Street bank. I just don't want to make sure we lose all of our banks. And like President Bush at the time, I was concerned that if we didn't do something, there was a pretty high risk that not just Wall Street banks, but all banks would collapse. Yeah. And like many other people, many other economists, they were concerned that our entire currency system would go down.
Yeah, that's a nice try, Mitt, but here comes Reasonable Ron to cut this act right down to size.
First, I don't like the idea that you have good bailouts and bad bailouts. If bailouts are bad, they're bad, and we shouldn't be doing it. But this argument about maybe one that works, you know, well, now that the bankruptcy or the bailing out of GM worked, I said that's sort of like if a criminal goes out and robs a bank and he's successful, therefore you endorse what he did because he's successful. But you have to rob people. You have to distort the law.
You might be asking yourself where Newt Gingrich is during all this noise. And the answer is he was a virtual non-factor in the debate. Just doing what he does best. Sounding absolutely ridiculous.
This is what you need to do. I think it was totally appropriate for you to ask for what you got. I just think it's kind of silly for you to then turn around and run an ad attacking somebody else for getting what you got and then claiming what you got wasn't what they got because what you got was right and what they got was...
But of course, Newt's not the only one with the natural talent to make an utter ass of himself. No, Republicans are literally stumbling over each other for that honor.
Bill, okay, go ahead.
Mr. Speaker,
go ahead.
You're entitled to your opinions, Mitch. You're not entitled to the, you know, to,
I've heard that
to
line
misrepresent,
before. I've heard
misrepresent
that before.
The facts, yeah, and you're misrepresenting the facts. You don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, that was a very torturous route to support
just
a guy
as torturous
who's a
someone
who's a pro-choice.
Just
a
about as torturous
candidate.
As 6 years
by the way,
Let's move the conversation along.
If not for John King's strict disciplinary tactics, this debate would surely have burst at the seams and ended with Romney getting Santorum into a full Nelson, while Ron Paul worked the torso and Gingrich greased himself up out back for his patented human cannonball gig. Although all signs point to the contrary, the Republican candidates do stand united on at least one point. With one exception.
We are prepared. We are considering military options. They're not just on the table. They are in our hand. We must not allow Iran to have a nuclear weapon.
We should have our allies covertly helping destroy the Assad regime. There are plenty of Arab-speaking groups that will be quite happy. There are lots of weapons available in the Middle East.
We'll send that very clear message to Iran as to the seriousness of the American public. To stop them from getting a nuclear weapon, there'd be no better candidate than me because I have been on the trail of Iran and trying to advocate for stopping them getting a nuclear weapon for about 8 years now.
It's very interesting that you're seeing on the Republican platform a very strong commitment to say we're going to say no to Iran. It's unacceptable for Iran to have a nuclear weapon.
I disagree because we don't know if they have a weapon. Matter of fact, there's no evidence that they have it. I don't want them to get a weapon, but I think what we're doing is encouraging them to have a weapon because they feel threatened. If you look at a map of Iran, we have 45 bases around their country, plus our submarines. The Iranians can't possibly attack anybody, and we're worrying about the possibility of one nuclear weapon.
Now, obviously, this is where Ron Paul really distinguishes himself from the other candidates. He's been rallying for peace long before he ever decided to run for the GOP nomination. His explanations are so fundamentally logical that it really brings out the hysteria that's embedded in the American public. They're so terrified of being the victims of any sort of attack that they seem to have no qualms at all about decimating any group of people who have the misfortune of making them feel uncomfortable.
Now, we have accepted now for 10 years that we're allowed to start war. We call it preemptive war, preventive war. Well, that's an aggressive war. I believe in the Christian just war theory that you have to morally justify the war in defense. Now, if we're defending our country and we need to defend, believe me, men and women will be in combat and defending our country, and that's the way it should be. But when it's an offensive war going where we shouldn't be, that's quite a bit different. So it's the foreign policy that needs examining.
Despite how logical or reasonable Paul's ideas regarding foreign policy might be, they are still met with fierce outrage by the majority of American people.
And if you want to worry about nuclear weapons, worry about the nuclear weapons that were left over from the Soviet Union. They're still floating around. They don't have them all detailed. So we're ready to go to war. I say going to war rapidly like this is risky and it's reckless. Now, if they're so determined to go to war, the only thing I plead with you for, if this is the case, is do it properly. Ask the people and ask the Congress for a declaration of war. This is war. People are going to die and you got to get a declaration of war.
Would you imagine that? Respecting the law when invading a foreign country. More gibberish from crazy old Ron. The good news is that these clowns need to actually get elected before they can do any physical damage. Conventional wisdom shows Romney easily taking Arizona. The state has a huge Baptist population, which somehow means they're all going to vote for the Mormon. But in Michigan, Santorum's had the lead in the polls all week. But Mitt's been closing in, to the point where they're about neck and neck now. If Romney takes both states tomorrow, he'll be riding the rapids to the Super Tuesday, where 10 states hold elections in one 24-hour period. Now, in 2008, Super Tuesday solidified John McCain's grasp on the nomination. Will this year be the same? I'll leave you to ponder that outstanding bummer until next week. And it's now time for the weekday weather forecast with Phil from the Storm Club. How's it doing? How's it going, Phil?
Good. Good? Thank you, Martin.
Got some good news for us?
We'll get to that. Thank you, Martin, and hello, listeners. Hope you all enjoyed the week off as much as I did. A quick recap. A few scattered rain systems came by and went, but overall, it was a relatively pleasant 7 days. If anything, the temperature was consistently on the chilly side, and the sky was always cloud-covered, but that's hardly anything to shed tears over compared to what the model suggests we're in for this week. Dropping air pressures and a comma cloud heading towards us both suggest active weather later in the week, likely bringing high winds and precipitation. Weather Canada has even issued forecasts of likely flurries as the temperature still lingers on the low side for this time of the year. I guess nature's way of saying welcome back to school. Now, your 5-day weekday weather forecast for UBC. Tonight, cloudy, high of 2, low of negative 3. Tuesday, cloudy, rain, high of 6, low of 3. Wednesday, cloudy with 70% chance of rain showers or flurries, high of 7, low of 3. Thursday, cloudy with 40% chance of showers or flurries, high of 7, low of 1. Friday, rain, high of 6, low of 3. So that's your 5-day weekday weather forecast for UBC, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. Currently, it is 2 degrees Celsius here on campus. I'm with CJ, Claire, Iqbal, and Martin in the sub. For News 101, I'm Phil Chang.
Thanks, Phil. We're going to take a quick little break for some public service announcements. We'll be back. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Black History Month is the brainchild of the great African-American historian and activist Carter G. Woodson. Born in 1975, Woodson grew up recognizing that the history of African-Americans, along with other cultures, were being ignored or misrepresented. Originating in Chicago as Negro History Week in 1926, Black History Month reached official status in Canada by 1995. This was mainly through the efforts of two women, the first Black Canadian woman elected to Parliament, the Honorable Jean Augustine, and Rosemary Sadlier, president of the Ontario Black History Society. Get out and really hustle. This PSA was brought to you in support of Black History Month on CITR 101.9 FM. Eventually I'll be left behind if I
don't. Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
And now we're going to go to more international. To Free Speech Radio News and their website, fsrn.org.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. Violence sparked by U.S. troops who burned the Quran continues in Afghanistan. 9 people died today when a suicide bomber detonated at the gates of an airport and NATO base in Jalalabad. Dozens have died in the last 6 days. The United Nations moved all staff out of its office in Kunduz after an attack Saturday. They say they will continue to provide services in the region. And NATO, France, the U.S., and the U.K. have all recalled their staff from Afghan ministries, citing security concerns. The U.S. has extended apologies for the desecration of the Quran, calling it an accident. In Yemen today, outgoing President Ali Abdullah Saleh formally handed over power to Abrabu Mansour Hadi. Hadi was elected by a landslide. He was the only candidate on the ballot. The country's prime minister stayed away from the ceremony in protest. Other protesters took to the streets outside. Deposed President Saleh returned to the country for the event. It's unclear where he will settle. Hadi will serve a transitional term of 2 years when new elections will be held. Several hundred people, Latino, African American, and white, marched down Main Street in East Haven, Connecticut Saturday, calling for the mayor to resign in the wake of a racial profiling scandal. Melinda Tuhus reports from East Haven.
The people united will never be defeated.
Marchers carried signs united against racial profiling and huge banners made of many nations' flags. Last month, East Haven's longtime police chief retired after being named an unindicted co-conspirator in the racial profiling case in which four officers were arrested. During the years-long Justice Department probe, former chief Leonard Gallo was placed on leave. When Mayor Joe Maturo took office, he reinstated Gallo and staunchly defended the chief. In recent weeks, Maturo's been widely criticized for making derogatory remarks about Latinos. Herman Zuniga led the new group of East Haven immigrants who organized the march. He said cooperation was excellent with the interim police chief, who came from outside the department.
The police department is changing, but we need more changes than that.
Some East Haveners along the route were supportive, while others said they wished the immigrants would just go away. After the march, Mayor Maturo released a statement praising all involved and pledging to rebuild trust with all segments of the community. Melinda Tuhus, FSRN, East Haven.
In a military court in Hawaii last Friday, a jury found Lance Corporal Carlos Orozco III not guilty of all charges related to the suicide in Afghanistan of Lance Corporal Henry Liu. Orozco was charged for allegedly hazing Liu before his death. He was the last of three soldiers charged. The first settled for 30 days and a one-rank demotion. The second was also fully acquitted. The Indian government lodged a formal complaint today with the International Olympic Committee demanding they cancel a sponsorship deal with Dow Chemical. Bismillah Gilani reports.
The complaint follows last week's announcement by the International Olympic Committee, or IOC, that they would not drop Dow Chemicals as one of the main sponsors of the 2012 London Olympics. The sports minister said the IOC's decision goes against the very ideals of the Olympic movement. Dow is the current owner of the Union Carbide Corporation, the firm responsible for Bhopal gas disaster, which caused the deaths of as many as 20,000 people. In New Delhi today, hundreds of victims of Bhopal disaster held a demonstration urging the government to boycott the summer games. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
Changes to Google's privacy policies will take effect this week. Beginning Thursday, Google will share information about who you are and where you go on the internet with other Google services. Last Friday, a federal judge dropped a lawsuit brought by the Electronic Privacy Information Center that sought to force the FTC to block the Google changes. Judge Amy Berman Jackson did not address the merits of the privacy changes. She only said that it wasn't up to the court to force the FTC to take action. FTC Chair John Leibowitz said Sunday that if a given company is explicit about how they use data, then consumers can make informed choices and market competition over privacy policies may emerge. But he would not say much about the specific Google privacy changes.
Other than saying that they have been clear and that it's a fairly binary and somewhat brutal choice that they're giving consumers, I think I can't say much more, and I'll just leave it at that. But we're aware.
Last year, the Federal Trade Commission and Google reached a settlement on privacy after the internet giant tried to force users onto Google Buzz and publicized private information. For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
In Syria, military attacks continued in cities throughout the country today as residents and activist groups reported heavy shelling of civilian centers and raids and arrests by government forces. At least 185 people have been killed since Saturday, according to the local coordination committees, a coalition of activist groups. The group also revised the total death toll to more than 8,000, including more than 5,800 civilians since pro-democracy protests began under the regime of Bashar al-Assad nearly a year ago. The Red Cross delivered food and other goods to the central city of Hama today. According to the aid group, it was the first time staff reached residents since mid-January. Also today, the European Union imposed new sanctions against Syria's regime, including freezing the assets of the country's central bank. The increasing pressure and ongoing violence takes place as the Assad regime announced the approval of a constitutional referendum today. Assad and Syria's ally Russia pointed to the referendum as a sign of reform, but media reports showed light turnout at polls on Sunday, and activists criticized the legitimacy of a vote during ongoing attacks and violence. For more, we go to Hivin Kako, spokesperson for the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. She joins us from Oxford, England. Thanks for speaking with us.
Hi, welcome.
Today marks more than 3 weeks since the military stepped up shelling of neighborhoods of homes. What updates have you heard from residents there?
Well, unfortunately, we have such a bad news. We have confirmed it very recently. I mean, the first thing is, like, so far today, we had 12 people have been killed in the bombardment of different neighborhoods and homes, including 11 in Bab al-Amr. But the shocking news that we just confirmed half an hour ago that 68 dead bodies has arrived to the National Hospital in the city of Homs.
And these 68 bodies that, as you say, you've just confirmed taken to the hospital within the last hour, what more do you know about how they were killed and the circumstances around their deaths?
We have no more information so far. We're still working to find out more information, but so far is that these people, they were running away, leaving the city of Homs, and they were killed, and their body have reached to the hospital in the last hour. So it's quite 68 bodies, and we're still checking if more bodies will arrive later. We're calling for an investigation, and we're calling that some members of a respectable organization, including some lawyers from our organization, to join in this investigation.
Well, this has been a concern with the situation in Homs. Aid groups have called it a humanitarian crisis. Is there any sign that there is access to residents of Homs to get medical supplies or food and basic supplies to residents there?
Well, so far still, the Red Cross cannot get access to the city. It's not working. The humanitarian situation in general is miserable all across Homs. They need an urgent help, and we still calling for the international community to force the Syrian regime to accept to get help to the city, to help these people, to have medical to get medical attention. It's still, the situation is unchanged. It's very miserable.
The BBC is reporting a fresh offensive against northern towns, reporting that troops have been firing artillery, mortars, and anti-aircraft guns near Idlib. What about the northern area or other parts that have seen violence today?
Well, so far today, 4 people were killed in the rural area of Aleppo City and in the city of Anadan. And there have been clashes and in Idlib as well, where 9 people were killed. One of them were killed under torture. The rest were killed in the clashes today. And in the clashes between the regular army and army defector, 6 members of the army and security forces were killed at the city of Anadan in Aleppo. That's the north of Syria, and there were clashes, and yes, there is news of a helicopter as well falling down, and 6 members of the regular army being killed in the north of Syria in the city of Aleppo.
There was also news today about the opposition movement, and a wing of the opposition Syrian National Council broke off and formed a different group that does support armed resistance to the government. This comes from the international conference in Tunis last week that did not recognize a single group as representative of the opposition movement. And the U.S. has been reluctant to endorse any one group. What's the effect on mounting a strong opposition to Assad's regime, having the opposition divided as it is?
Well, I mean, we blame this fragmented opposition to be part of prolonging the suffering of the Syrian people. I mean, we hope that they will unify and be strong enough so that the international community can give them support and things can get moving forward, because we need the international community and the world to support the Syrian people and the opposition to have a solution similar to the Yemeni scenario, where they pressurize al-Assad to step down and agree for a transitional period for somebody to step in and get Syria towards democracy slowly.
Hiven Kako is a spokesperson for the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. She joined us from England for an update on the situation in Syria. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
The European Union's efforts to combat global warming are increasingly angering other countries, including the US. These countries and their powerful industries are now pressuring EU officials to weaken or abandon some of the strongest climate policies in the world. From France, FSRN's Liam Moriarty has more.
On Wednesday, government and industry representatives from the US, China, India, and more than 20 other countries wrapped up a two-day meeting in Moscow. The purpose of the meeting? To devise ways to punish the European Union for making foreign airlines take part in the EU carbon emissions market. All commercial flights into or out of European airports now will have to pay for carbon emissions that exceed strict EU limits. After the meeting, U.S. State Department spokesman Mark Toner told reporters in Washington that Europe needs to back off.
We believe that the EU needs to cease application of this scheme to foreign airlines and engage meaningfully with the International Civil Aviation Organization to find and develop a global approach to this problem.
Participants at the Moscow meeting came away with a raft of retaliatory measures to make life harder and more expensive for European airlines, including fees for use of foreign airspace and restrictions on flight corridors and landing privileges. So far, Europe isn't backing down. EU spokesperson Isaac Valero-Ladron notes that the EU went ahead on its own only after more than a decade of negotiations on a global plan for cutting aviation emissions went nowhere.
Rather than asking us for the suspension of the only functioning system that exists to address aviation carbon emissions, these countries criticizing the EU should come forward with concrete and constructive proposals.
In the meanwhile, Valero-Ladron says, the EU law will stand, and air carriers that don't play ball can be fined or even denied access to European airports. The day after the Moscow meeting, foreign pressure prevented another EU climate law from going forward. As part of the EU's cap-and-trade carbon market, all fossil fuels are given a rating based on their greenhouse gas impact. Citing studies that show fuels derived from tar sands have a carbon footprint about 22% bigger than conventional oil, the EU planned to reflect that in tar sand oil's carbon rating. This week, documents surfaced that reveal an intensive Canadian campaign to block the tar sands rating. When the EU's Isaac Valero-Ladron was repeatedly pressed by reporters to describe the Canadian pressure, he resorted to diplomatic clichés.
We had a constructive and continued dialogue with the Canadian authorities, and we received some letters, and we had exchange of letters.
But Nusa Urbancic with Transport and Environment, one of the NGOs that used public records requests to uncover the documents, says Canada has been going all out to kill the tar sands rating.
These documents show that the Commission was under a lot of pressure, and it also shows that this pressure is now continuing at the national level of different EU countries.
Canada has linked the tar sands issue to renewal of the free trade agreement between Canada and the EU, currently being negotiated. Canadian officials have warned of possible trade retaliation, repeatedly insisting they will defend Canada's interests. In a crucial vote Thursday, the EU failed to pass the fuel quality ratings, postponing the decision for further consideration. Nearly all governments say that global warming is a serious threat, and they accept the scientific findings that greenhouse gas emissions have to be slashed dramatically and soon to head off catastrophic climate change. So why are so many of them treating Europe like a stubborn child?
It's my firm belief that the European Union is actually acting responsibly at this point in time.
Thomas Fergerman heads Consinto, a Copenhagen-based green think tank. He says the pushback against EU climate policy comes largely from countries clinging to what he calls sundown industries, industries based on fossil fuels and other dwindling natural resources. Fergerman says that, as the world's largest economy, Europe is in a position to model a more sustainable approach.
The European perception is that green growth is the answer. So what we're trying to do in Europe is try to stimulate an economic growth that is based on green growth.
The European Union has committed to cutting greenhouse gases by at least 20% and getting 20% of its energy from renewables by 2020. The goal is to try to keep global temperature rise to no more than 2 degrees Celsius. As Europe phases in its program for meeting those goals, arguments such as the tar sands issue and the fight over aviation emissions are likely to keep flaring up. Liam Moriarty, FSRN, Normandy,
France. In Argentina, residents continue their efforts to oppose copper and gold mining. On Thursday, several thousand anti-mining protesters shut down traffic in central Buenos Aires as they marched from the Plaza del Congreso to the historic Plaza de Mayo. They hope to put an end to what they view as destructive mining practices in the Argentine Andes. Eilish O'Neill reports.
Friend Cristina, the singer says, addressing the Argentine president, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. We're not terrorists, we defend Famatina. Famatina is a town in the Argentine Andes. The Canadian Osisko Mining Company had planned gold exploration there, but it's paused operations in response to local protests. According to Claudius Erlan, a member of the Socialist Workers Movement, the people of Famatina learned from the experiences of other towns in the Andes.
There already are other confrontations in Argentina, like the Alumbrera, that haven't left anything to the people. That is, they haven't generated wealth or a better source of work. Instead, they've destroyed the environment. So with these examples, the people of Famatina oppose the mine.
The form of mining used to extract gold and copper from the Andes is la minería cielo abierto, or open pit mining. Maria Damasceno came to Thursday's rally because of her concerns about the environmental impacts of open pit mining techniques.
It's a very special kind of mining that's done by multinational corporations. What they're looking for is to, in very little time, cause a great deal of environmental harm in order to extract minerals, gold, lithium, other minerals. That brings a huge ecological problem because they destroy entire zones of the Andes.
Namaseno adds that open pit mining techniques require a huge amount of water and that they add contaminants to the soil. The protesters that gathered in Buenos Aires on Thursday hope to put an end to this form of mining throughout the Andes. Famatina, Andalgalá, the Andes, the speaker asks. They will not be touched, the protesters respond. Though the copper and gold mines are located in rural parts of the country, rally participant Nicolás Núñez says they affect all Argentines because contaminated rivers near the mines flow into the Río de la Plata, the river near Buenos Aires.
You can see the contamination in onion production, which is a vegetable that's eaten a lot in this country. Last year, they had to throw out all the onions from the San Juan province because you could see the onions were black because they were contaminated with cyanide.
The Canadian company Barrick Gold has had mining operations in San Juan since 2000. In fact, most of the mining companies operating in Argentina are based abroad.
Enrique Viale, the president of the Argentine Association of Environmentalist Lawyers, says these companies represent a challenge to Argentina's sovereignty.
The transnational companies appropriate the territory. It even affects the credibility of democracy. In the provinces where there's this kind of mega mining, there's no division of power. All the power is in the service of mining capital.
Viale hopes that marching from the Plaza del Congreso to the Plaza de Mayo will have a symbolic effect.
In one is a legislative power, the Congress. In the other is the executive power, the president of the nation. So we bring our message to both powers, one so that it changes the laws, and the other so that it stops using mining as a model of, quote, development.
The Plaza de Mayo isn't just the location of the Casa Rosada, Argentina's executive mansion. It's also been the site of protests throughout the country's history, such as those against the military dictatorship of the late 1970s and early 1980s. Thursday's march to the plaza was just one in a series of anti-mining demonstrations that have been held across the country for several months. Continued protests are planned for early March. Ailish O'Neill, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
Thanks to Free Speech Radio News for bringing us those international headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at their website, fsrn.org. You are listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca.
And that's our program for February 27th, 2012. Today's broadcast is brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us an important news tip, please contact us by email at news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to a podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. You can also listen to our past interviews on the News 101 page on mixcloud.com. For more independent news, join us on Mondays and Fridays at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Iqbal Ahmed.
And I'm Martin Lumlin. Today's show was produced by CJ and Claire Eagle. From the entire news team at CITR, thanks for listening.
Stay tuned for Sword Throat's Clapping Hands at 6 o'clock.
Thank you.